You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, state Republican leaders say they hope to limit the powers of the governor's office before Democrat Tony Evers takes office as governor in January. We'll find out what changes could be in the works. First, the blaze known as the Camp Fire in Northern California is on the verge of becoming the deadliest wildfire in state history. It's also the most destructive in terms of the number of buildings destroyed. Meanwhile, two smaller fires continue to burn near Los Angeles. And firefighters may not get much help from the weather. Officials say hot, dry winds are expected to continue through tomorrow evening, raising the risk of new fires being ignited by flying embers. So what's causing these fires, and what, if anything, can be done to minimize the threat from future fires? Stephen Pine is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. He's written more than 30 books, including Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Before we dig into the bigger picture of fires and their prevention, can you talk about this particular fire, the Camp Fire, and why it seems to have spread so quickly and been so devastating?
Well, I don't have details. I'm gleaning out from what I've been able to read from the major news. But it's really the same formula as hit Northern California last fall. You've got a lot of open country with towns embedded in it. In this case, we seem to be in a valley, in effect a flume for carrying winds. And, of course, we have really strong offshore winds. The northern winds tend to be called the monos. They have different names. Southern California, they're Santa Anas, but it's essentially the same wind. What's missing in this is the cause. Last fall, there were almost all power lines. That may be the case here. I don't think we know yet. But if so, then you have an ignition that occurs under absolutely the worst possible conditions. That is, it is the high winds that result that cause the ignition, set that into motion, and then propel it. And then it goes through a lot of grass and low woodland areas. And in this case, you have a community right in the way, and it is just overrun by a veritable blizzard of sparks, and millions of sparks. Any point of vulnerability, they'll find it.
It seems like there have been a lot of simple answers offered up over the years to prevent wildfires, more logging, or climate change is the culprit, or people live too close to fire-prone areas. Reading some of what you've written about this, it's way more complicated than any answer you could sum up in one line, I think. Is that right?
It is. I think the way I've come to think about fires, remember that fires are reaction. So it's synthesizing its setting. And I think of it as a driverless car. It's barreling down the road, integrating everything around it. And at some points, there's a steep curve called climate change. Maybe another place, there's a bad intersection we call where people and nature are colliding. It may be, the road's filled with potholes and road debris left from, poor land use practices. It's all of these. And at any one place and occasion, one tends to dominate, but they're all out there. And I actually, that makes it complicated, but I regard it as good news because it means there are lots of points of intervention possible. There's no one thing that we have to do. There are many things we can do, and a lot of the small things can add up.
We'll dig into some of those different strategies that would help. I want to start now with President Trump. He put out a tweet over the weekend. I'm quoting here. There is no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. Remedy now or no more Fed payments. So keying in on this idea that forests are being mismanaged, that's why we have a fire like the Camp Fire. What do you say to that?
Well, if everybody in California vanished overnight, California would still have large fires. It would have explosive fires, and some of them wouldn't stop till they reached the Pacific. So we can aggravate those conditions. We can ameliorate those conditions, but we're not going to stop the fundamentals. They're simply built into the physical geography of California. There are things we can do. The one big point of mediation is vegetation or fuels. We can't stop winds, we can't stop mountains, We can intervene with fuels and where we choose to live, how we choose to live on the landscape, where we choose to put our communities and so forth. Those are things we can do. And we haven't paid as much attention maybe as we should. I think reading the Trump administration's subtext, they simply want more logging. And there's no evidence that logging is going to solve the problem. There's plenty of evidence that logging, unless you clean up very expensively afterwards, will aggravate the problem. So I think that's this might simply be misdirection. They're using alarm and horror over an event to try to promote something which they want, but which really doesn't solve it. And the issue is a simple one, that fire is a chemical process. Logging is a physical one. It removes stuff. Logging takes the big stuff and leaves the little. Fire burns the little stuff and leaves the big. So, you know, after this fire, those portions of it that even go through forests, you'll see lots of burned tree trunks. Well, that's exactly what logging would have taken out in advance. So it's hard to understand how that's going to change the outcome. Instead, all the debris that's left, all that small stuff, is some of the most volatile fuels known on the planet. So you have to clean those up. Maybe often you burn it, which leads to possibility for escape fires. And it certainly causes lots of smoke. So there are always trade-offs. It's hard to see that logging is a solution here.
Talking to Stephen Pine, wildfire expert at Arizona State University, about the current wildfires in California and more generally why wildfires happen and how to mitigate their damage. And Stephen, let's get into a bunch of those small things you mentioned. There's a lot of different things, maybe some appropriate for different areas. It seems like one big point that you write about is an idea of, and you were alluding to this, fuel management. How in an area where people are living, in a place where fires might happen, how do we manage the fuel that feeds those flames?
Yeah, there's a place, there are a bunch of small things you can do, and again, they depend on the local conditions. There's a place where you may want to put in expansive green belts around some of these communities, so that when a fire hits it, it may still propagate, but it's not going to rage with the kind of intensity that we're seeing slamming into these communities. You may want to do some prescribed burning. In other words, substitute some preemptive, controlled, or tame burning for unpredicted wildfire. Why turn your fire problem over to lightning or power lines or arsonists? Do the burning yourself. There are places where you may want to thin out the woods, particularly the understory, because that's the small stuff that burns, particularly where the landscape is used to lots of surface fires. And if you eliminate those, then it tends to grow up with a much thicker cover over that story, which leads to intense fires and can actually get into the canopies of the trees. So that's a place, that's a kind of woody weeding. It's thinning. It's not really logging in the sense, because you're not hauling out much merchantable timber, if any. And there may be some places where some prescribed logging, if you will, would be appropriate, particularly around communities, as a way of thinning out some of this, some of the canopy, particularly where fires naturally spread through the canopies. So in that case, you may want to interrupt the canopy. But these are all different things, and they're all going to depend, and very few of them will probably pay for themselves on their own. They'd almost all require some kind of fiscal subsidy. But even more, there's the political capital that has to be expended. And I would say even beyond that, the social capital, getting people to agree that there's a problem, getting them to agree on what cocktail of solutions they can live with. That seems to be the fundamental stumbling block. We know plenty about fire and fire behavior and how communities burn. To begin resolving these issues, we don't need to wait for a large research project. We simply, at this point, we just don't seem to have mustered the sense that it's a big enough problem. And I'm beginning to think of these mass burnings as the flip side of mass shootings. It just, another town burned, another community got shot up. You keep thinking we've reached a tipping point, and we haven't gotten there yet.
When it comes to funding, we're obviously putting a lot of money into fighting fires as they're raging, into recovery after. Is that taking money away from preventing fires?
Well, yes and no. There are emergency funds which are available, but Congress changed the rules a while back, and so the federal agencies in particular are having to draft out of their regular operating budgets, and that gets complicated. And then you have the states, where the states have primary responsibility, and this is a CAL FIRE, a state operation. Many of the big fires in Oregon earlier this year are state operations, and the state is having to pay serious money, tens of millions of dollars, to manage, to deal with these fires. And that's requiring supplemental appropriations. So we can no longer foist all of the costs on the feds, and the feds can't foist all of it on emergency responses. At some point, you decide that, you know, preventative measures, some remediation is really in order. Otherwise, it's like you know, a healthcare program where you spend billions on emergency response, but not very much on vaccinations or simply basic wellness visits.
I want to touch on global warming before we're done. We have had fires, wildfires, pre-global warming. We would continue to have them without. That said, does global warming make wildfires more likely or more destructive?
Well, it changes it. And the key ingredient, I think, for fire, understanding fire, is the rhythm of wetting and drying. So you have to, it has to be wet enough to grow fuel and then dry enough to let it burn. And where you have that on an annual or frequent basis, then you have a natural fire. And what global warming seems to be doing is accentuating those rhythms. They're getting more extreme. In many ways, it's a performance enhancer. It's acting on a set of conditions and generally worsening it. There may be places where it changes, it flips it to wetter conditions or others, but we would have to see how that actually plays out in particular settings.
We'll leave it there for now. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. Have a good one.
Stephen Pine is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. He's written more than 30 books, including Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. Talked with him about the causes of wildfires and what can be done to prevent them. Coming up, we'll talk with a state capitol reporter about Republican plans to limit the powers of the governor before Democrat Tony Evers takes office. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, getting around Wisconsin, if you can't drive a car with public transportation, can be extremely difficult depending on where you live. We'll talk about a new report looking at some of the transit inequalities in the state and possible solutions. First, state Republican leaders say they plan to pass limits to the power of the governor's office before Democrat Tony Evers is inaugurated in January. Some of the powers in question were given to Governor Scott Walker by Republican lawmakers when he took office in 2011. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald hope to get the legislature back in session by the end of the year to consider the changes, which they say will ensure balance in state government. Democrats, meanwhile, say it's a grab for power. Patrick Marley is a state capitol reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we have right after the election, basically, Patrick, the leaders of Republicans in both chambers of the legislature saying, yeah, we need to dial back some powers of the governor. Do we know specifically what they're talking about changing?
We certainly do not. They've talked in generalities about doing some things related to administrative rules, which have the force of state law and implement state statutes. And they've talked generally about appointments. We haven't seen anything specifically that they will do. We're waiting to see if they can muster the votes for something like this and then exactly what they would do.
So let's talk about what they could and couldn't do. One thing, the Wisconsin governor has a powerful line item veto, which means that he or she doesn't just say yes or no to a bill, but they can get in there and cross out words, change numbers in some cases. that's in the Constitution, right? The legislature can't change that along with Governor Walker. They can't do that by themselves.
That's right. That's one of the most powerful tools that the governor has. It relates to any legislation that appropriates money or has fiscal elements to it. They cannot get at that because that would take a constitutional amendment, which requires the voters of the state. So there's nothing like that they can do. So whatever they may do, you know, there are sort of core powers of the governor that they cannot get at. It sounds like what they're talking about may have to do with, you know, how people are appointed, who's appointed to different boards, whether you have, you know, the legislature do that, or maybe more of a mix of the legislature and the governor appointing people to boards. And in these aspects of state rules, they've mentioned voter ID. There's some rules implementing that law. They've talked about putting the rules into state law so that Evers would have less ability to change what some aspects of the voter ID law, for instance, are.
And that had changed under Governor Walker and Republicans in the legislature, right? They had, I mean, the legislature passes law, the governor signs it, but then how it gets implemented, there's still a lot of wiggle room. And basically, if I have this right, the legislature gave the governor more power, more flexibility on how those rules get implemented. That is potentially a big change from Walker to Evers if these changes are made.
When Walker came into office, one of the first laws they passed changed some things on administrative rules, and it gave the legislature some more review in certain cases, and it gave the governor more ability to sign off on rules early in the process and block rules early in the process. So it actually gave some powers to each. They're talking, it appears, to be changing those rules. So they could give the legislature much more say and require more oversight from the legislature on those rules that implement state laws. That would be a change from what Governor Walker's enjoyed in his 8 years in power.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was asked yesterday about his plans to limit the governor's powers. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Tony Evers is governor not because he got any kind of a mandate. There is no mandate for his agenda. He won the election, and I congratulate him on that. The outcome is not what I wanted, but I certainly am not going to forget that the rest of Wisconsin, outside of the people who live in Dane County and Milwaukee, want to make sure that we have that balance, and my job is to make sure that the policies that have made Wisconsin successful stay on the books and that we don't roll back all of the reforms that have us as one of the most successful economies in the country.
Doesn't sound like necessarily smooth sailing between the Republican legislature and the Democratic governor-elect, based on what we heard there, Patrick.
That's absolutely true. I was just listening to Speaker Voss, who just got another term as Speaker from the Republican majority. They were meeting in caucus today. That is his message, is we do not have a mandate from Democrats. We have split government. That's what the voters chose. So he's very much saying that the Republicans who control both houses of the legislature will serve as a check on Governor Tony Evers. So it's going to be tough for both Republican lawmakers to get what they want through. It's also going to be very hard for Tony Evers to get what he wants in this environment.
Patrick Marley is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a possible lame duck session. A few items on the table, possible changes to the power of the governor. Patrick, originally there had been talk of some kind of extraordinary or special session looking at incentives for the Kimberly-Clark company, Foxconn-style incentives to help keep some Kimberly-Clark jobs in the state. So what's the status of convening the legislature at all for anything right now?
It's a little unclear. So on Wednesday, the legislature's budget committee is going to hold a hearing on this incentive package for Kimberly-Clark. It is a bill that gives proportionally the same kind of incentives that went to Foxconn to Kimberly-Clark. This is to save about 500 jobs in the Fox Valley. The Assembly's already passed it. The Senate has been reluctant to do so. Governor Walker, in the final weeks of his campaign, said that he wanted to have the legislature come in after the election with the notion that the politics of this issue might calm down a little bit after we have the election. The Senate president is Roger Roth. He is from the area and a lead sponsor of the bill. He said the same thing. The reality is that the Republicans who control the Senate are short of the votes, perhaps well short of that. They've said they would need some Democratic votes. They won't say how many, or haven't said how many they would need. Democrats do not appear to be supportive of this bill at all. I have not found a Democrat who said they would vote for this. So there's where the situation is. We'll perhaps know more after this hearing is held, but I don't know that we've seen anything yet that would suggest the votes are starting to emerge on that legislation.
If the legislature reconvenes, they could tackle that. They could, depending on how it's set up, tackle other issues. Has Governor Walker weighed in on this idea of changing, limiting the powers of his successor as governor?
No, he's been, he lost the election a week ago. He put out a statement the day after, you know, thanking people, but he has not spoken to this issue of whether, you know, post-election he does want to come back in Kimberly-Clark or whether he's going to try to work on Republican lawmakers to get them to support it. He also has not said whether he would, because any bill that changes the rules for the next governor would have to be signed by Governor Walker. He hasn't said if he's willing to do that or what he thinks of it.
And what have we heard from Governor-elect Tony Evers on this?
He says that you know, voters just chose him, that that he sees this as a power play. He does not want them to do it. And he says he's looking for common ground and willing to work with Republicans, but that they cannot start things by taking away some of his powers and responsibilities.
Have we heard much in the way of common ground messaging from Republican leaders in the legislature? Have they said, okay, yeah, we got this limit your power thing, but here's some other stuff we could work with you on?
So Republicans have said they feel like they've had good job working with Democrats in recent years on combating the opioid crisis and that they would attempt to do that some more. Robin Voss has mentioned some foster care measures that he thinks can get bipartisan support. And I think the biggest issue we've seen out there that has the possibility of bipartisan cooperation is transportation. The Republicans in the Assembly had supported in the last session some kind of revenue increase for roads. Tony Evers said he's very open to that. So it could be that they find additional money to put into highways and local roads. But it's still going to be a contentious issue if it could involve a gas tax increase, which the Senate Republicans have been much less crazy about. It could involve tolling, which would have some concerns for some lawmakers. So we'll have to see. But it does seem like an area where at least a large number of Republican lawmakers are in more or less the same place as Tony Evers on that issue.
Patrick, thanks a lot for bringing us up to speed today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Patrick Marley is a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about Republican plans to potentially limit the power of Governor-elect Tony Evers in a special session of the state legislature. To be continued. Coming up, a new report highlights some of the shortfalls in public transit systems around Wisconsin. We'll talk about some of the ways cities and towns could make it easier for residents to get around. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, smoking has dropped a lot in the United States, but that's mostly for middle and upper income groups. A health expert tells us why lower income Americans haven't seen such a big drop in tobacco use. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, where you live in Wisconsin can have a huge impact on how you get around. That's especially true if you count on some kind of public transportation for some or all of your daily transportation needs. A new study commissioned by several Wisconsin nonprofit groups found that the needs of state residents are not being met by the systems in place right now, especially as demand grows for more public transit options, in part because of an aging population. Our next guest is here to talk about some of the challenges facing transit systems statewide and steps that can be taken to improve public transportation. Cassandra Steiner is the Personal Relations and Outreach Associate for the Sierra Club of Wisconsin. She's one of the co-authors of the report called Arrive Together, Transportation Access and Equity in Wisconsin. Cassie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think when people think of public transportation, they might think of a big city, Milwaukee size or Madison size. You went around the state looking at a lot of different size of communities. Why is that?
Yeah. So we looked at transit systems as large as Milwaukee County Transit and as small as Namekagon Transit in Hayward, Wisconsin, which has a population of around 3,500. And we looked at these various size of communities because public transportation looks different in all of these places, but it's working at getting people around in all of these places. So it's an important part of our transportation system.
Before we dig into how these transportation systems shake up, let's look at the demand. I think especially outside of those bigger cities, people think, well, if you live in a smaller community, you're going to have a car, so public transit isn't such a big deal. Let's first of all talk about that aging population I mentioned. People stop driving, then what?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is aging rapidly, and we're seeing this happen, especially in rural counties. And so as our population gets older, people are outliving their ability to drive, which means that they need the ability to get around. If they don't have family nearby or if they cannot drive, that can lead to people being stranded in their homes or having to leave their homes sooner than they would like to move into facilities.
And you also partnered with some disability advocacy groups as part of this report. Can you talk about their transportation needs?
Yeah, we partnered with the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. If you are visually impaired or if you have a disability, that means you cannot drive. Public transportation is your lifeline. And one of the interviews that we had by a transit rider named Kathy in Wausau, she always says the bus is her car keys to independence.
And then the third big group, I've talked to people who work on jobs issues in the state, and they say, okay, for that lower paid worker who has to commute to some kind of job, they are one car repair, one expensive car bill away from unemployment.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether they can't afford a car to begin with or whether it's one car that's moving their household around, public transportation connects workers to jobs in a lot of areas of our state.
All right, now let's start to look at what we have available here. Before we look at particular communities, big picture, as you write in the report, nobody has things perfect right now.
Yeah, that's correct. I think a lot of our transit systems are trying and know where the gaps in their service are. However, there has been a stalemate in funding and a decrease in funding around 2010 that has not been made up. And so our systems just cannot don't have the money from the state to support the riders that they need. And there's a lot of barriers to regional transportation collaboration as well.
And when you look at state funding priorities, how do public transportation systems of whatever kind stack up against car transit?
Not well. Transit systems are not funded very well, especially when you compare to highway expansion. So there's been a lot of discussion about our local roads needing more aid and more funding, and that's certainly true. And even a fraction of what we spend adding lanes to highways could be put into our transit systems or could be put into our local roads to really meet the needs of people around our state.
Talking to Cassandra Steiner from the Sierra Club, looking at a new report called Arrive Together, Transportation Access and Equity in Wisconsin. Let's start with the smallest community you looked at. You mentioned Hayward, Wisconsin. What kind of options are available there? Obviously, you don't build huge subway systems or fixed route sorts of things. That doesn't mean there's nothing. What is available in a community Hayward size?
Yeah, so Namekagon Transit is run in part by the Lacouture Reservation and in part by Sawyer County. It has three fixed routes with the casino as the hub. It started as kind of a tourist thing, probably to help move people who maybe had a couple drinks and didn't want to drive, but now does door-to-door pickup. And so these are not the big, long buses that you see in urban hubs. These are smaller shuttles, but they're wheelchair accessible, and they'll do door-to-door pickups within their service territory. And then they'll also travel once a week as far as 73 miles to the next small town so that people can go shopping or have an evening or afternoon away from their home in Hayward.
And what is missing in Hayward when it comes to transportation? What kind of obstacles are there?
Yeah, I think some of the obstacles are because it's a smaller system, not many people maybe know about it yet. It is also one of the newer systems. And then another barrier there is that this this system, because it does door-to-door pickup, you might have to schedule a couple of days in advance to make sure that your ride is accounted for.
Now, Hayward has a casino nearby. Not every community in the 1,000 to 5,000 resident range is going to have a hub option like that, maybe a funding option like that. So even if this is a success story, it's not necessarily something that other comparable communities around the state could replicate.
Even if communities don't have a huge central hub like a casino, there are options like share ride taxis or better carpool coordination so that people who, maybe got in a car accident or their car is in disrepair or they have a disability or outaging their ability to drive, have a way to get around. So there are a couple of options for smaller areas.
Let's go from smallest to biggest now in Milwaukee County. You mentioned at the other extreme. What positives, what obstacles did you find in Milwaukee County?
Milwaukee County Transit is our largest transit system, so it's serving by far the most riders. Some of the big barriers are that because we are not able to collaborate regionally with our transportation, the routes end often at the county line, and a lot of job growth is happening in nearby counties, Racine County and Waukesha County, most notably. And so workers, especially low-wage workers who can't afford vehicles, have very limited options to getting to their jobs. And there are currently job lines, they're called, that cross the county line from Milwaukee to Waukesha to bring people to industrial parks. But that funding was set to run out at the end of this year. Milwaukee County is extending some of that funding for one of those lines, but we're talking about hundreds of workers a day who might not have access anymore. And so certainly the regional piece is a huge concern in that area.
And not that long ago, 15 years ago, RTAs, regional transportation authorities, I think is what that stood for. They were all the rage. Everybody wanted to get them to solve exactly the kind of problem you're talking about. And then that was just, it seems like, shot down completely, right?
Yeah, we don't have any RTAs in Wisconsin right now. And we're one of the few states in the nation with large transit systems, especially like Milwaukee, that don't have these.
You looked at a number of communities and their transportation systems. Let's go to the Eau Claire area transportation system. What did you find when you looked out there?
Yeah, so Eau Claire is missing some access to northwestern Eau Claire, again, where a lot of job access is growing, a lot of development is happening. And this is a trend that we're seeing across Wisconsin and across the nation, where jobs are growing in the suburbs, population is growing in urban areas, and the transit systems just can't quite keep up with where the development is happening.
Are there efforts in Eau Claire to try to solve that, to bridge that gap?
Absolutely. I know that in most of the transit systems are trying to identify ways to get workers to jobs or people to the parts of the city they need to go. But again, funding is a huge hurdle for a lot of these transit systems.
We're talking to Cassie Steiner right now, Public Relations and Outreach Associate for the Sierra Club of Wisconsin. She's a co-author of the report, Arrive Together, Transportation Access and Equity in Wisconsin. She's with us to talk about that report and what can be done in communities around the state to make public transportation more accessible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the public transit system in your area? Is there a public transit system in your area? Have you found that it impacts how you get around? What could improve things in your part of the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about public transportation in the state, what's okay, what needs to get fixed, and the impact, good or bad, public transit has on your life. Cassie Steiner is with us from the Sierra Club of Wisconsin. She's co-author of the report, Arrive Together, Transportation Access and Equity in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have access to transportation in your part of the state if you can't drive, if you have an aging family member or someone with disabilities in your family? How do they get around? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jim is with us in New Franken. Jim, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think, Jim?
I think we're in a great need for public transit. We're living in LeClaire, as you had mentioned. If you happen to live in the town right next, 14 miles away, Triple Falls, there's no public transportation between the two cities, which the bus comes very close from LeClaire, but not quite to Triple Falls. And so that leaves the population out of that workforce from LeClaire. I've since moved to the Green Bay area side of the state. And again, Green Bay is great, but the outer areas, there's a great need. You know, I've traveled to Europe and been to Switzerland, and their bus services are far superior, their transit system. You know, and it's an honor system. You get on the bus and get off where you want.
And Jim, thanks a lot for calling in. So he's making the case that, okay, even if you've got, and you were touching on this with Eau Claire, Cassie, even if you've got that transportation within the city, maybe you want to get to the next town over.
Yeah. So we looked at transit systems that are based more locally and rather than regional things. You know, we could have looked at like Amtrak or other rail, or we didn't even touch on rail in the report. And so certainly moving from city to city, if you don't have a vehicle, is really challenging. And someone from the Council of the Blind was telling us her story about how it takes her 3 days if she wants to come to Madison from Eau Claire for a meeting that she has, or from La Crosse rather.
But in this case, Jim was saying Eau Claire to Chippewa Falls, mm-hmm. which is not a huge haul. And,
right.
And he saw problems with that there.
Yep, absolutely. So these systems could do so much more to connect people to the cities that are much closer to them.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling in. Fawn joins us now in Madison. Fawn, hello.
Hello. Hi. I seem to recollect about, I think, 10 years ago or so, the state legislature passed a bill outlawing the creation of regional transit authorities. I am befuddled as to why this should be the case. Who benefits from not allowing regional, like urban regions or even rural regions to coordinate so to get people from one place to another? I know in Dane County here we were stymied in trying to create something that would get people from the suburbs to the city and vice versa. And now that Foxconn is moving to outside Milwaukee, you would think it would be even more, you know, urgent to start building this. I wonder if now is a good time to revisit that question. Thank you.
Fawn, thanks for the call. Cassie?
Yeah, I think regional transportation authorities have a lot of benefits. They can, through a referendum, establish taxes to help fund the transit system. So that could answer some of the funding questions. And they also, again, allow for that regional collaboration so that a lot of the problems that we're seeing about crossing city or county lines could be resolved.
Thanks a lot for the call, Fawn. Thomas joins us next in Waukesha. Thomas, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I've got a few experiences. I'm 74 years old and still have a part-time job approximately 5.5 miles from my residence. And I do use a bicycle when I can to get to work. Waukesha has a hub-and-spoke system where you can get to a lot of places, but I actually make better time on my bicycle than when I take the city bus to work when the weather isn't good. And the lady talked about a lack of RTA, and whereas Milwaukee does serve outside Milwaukee County to Brookfield Square, I share an experience with a man who is blind. He works on Highway 100, has to walk approximately 1.3 miles crossing the freeway ramp access to get to his bus stop to get to the Milwaukee system. He gets on the Milwaukee system, transfers at Brookfield Square to a Waukesha bus, and again transfers from a Route 1 to a Route 9. He's spending like 1.75 hours to get home, and that's far too long. He's spending a lot of time sitting on buses in all sorts of adverse weather, whereas if there was some sort of a coordinated system with an RTA, I think it would be much easier for these people to get to and from their jobs.
Thomas, thanks a lot for the call. With that second point, Cassie, it sounds like Thomas's friend really cobbling things together if he wants to cross county lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And that story is one that we're hearing from a lot of people who live, you know, with systems that'll get them 1 mile or 2 miles, you know, away from where they need to go. And they have to figure out what that last mile or last 2 miles is going to look like for them.
Thanks for the call, Thomas. We're talking to Cassie Steiner from the Sierra Club of Wisconsin. She's co-author of the new report, Arrive Together, Transportation Access and Equity in Wisconsin, looking at public transportation alternatives, options, and obstacles in communities around the state. Back to your calls. John is with us in Windsor. John, hi.
Hi. You know, one of the things, I've been working in the disability field for 30 years. In the last 20 years, the number one issue has been transportation. And that's the number one impediment for individuals with disabilities to be able to get jobs. You know, you can't get from Comstock to Cumberland. I mean, that's 10 miles away. I think that it's something that we really need to realize, that we need to have public transportation. It's just a fact of life. It'll make life easier for all of us. And thank you for doing this study.
John, thanks for the call. We've touched on this a little, Cassie, but talk about the importance of this issue for people with disabilities.
Yeah, for people to live independently, it's important to be able to get around and have access to the same opportunities that someone who could drive or afford a car has.
John, thanks a lot for bringing that up. We'll go next to Jerry with us in River Falls. Jerry, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jerry?
Well, months ago, I read a deal in the paper where a guy was going to get funding and get a train running from Eau Claire to St. Paul and Minneapolis on the rail that runs straight with east and west with 94. And I was wondering whatever happened to that.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Cassie, I don't know if that's a story you had followed. You mentioned that trains weren't a part of this report. Are they potentially, you're mostly talking about getting around within a community and neighboring communities, but do you see trains as maybe part of a bigger solution?
Yeah, I think if we want to connect people who don't have cars around our state and to neighboring states, it certainly is an important option for people to get around. The report doesn't look at that. It does look more community-focused within the state. But certainly, people who can't drive, might have family across state lines or might want to take a vacation, and having ways to get around without a car is so important.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. Ted is with us next in Madison. Ted, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ted?
Well, we're consistently having problems with roads in Wisconsin and be able to fund repair and infrastructure. And shouldn't we look at a new way to fix our transportation system rather than keep doing the same old thing over and over again?
And do you see public transportation, Ted, being part of that?
Yeah, it would connect the state in a different way and would reduce costs on localities, on maintaining roads,
gotcha.
Reduce wear and tear.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Ted. Cassie, in our last minute, Ted kind of leads us here. In your report, you have kind of a different vision of success for public transportation. It's not about how many people ride a route or people hours. It's about are people connected to where they need to go? Can you talk about that as a goal?
Yeah. So rather than thinking about number of cars on a road or number of riders on a route, of course, we want to make sure that things are efficient, but we want to make sure that people can get to the destinations that they need to go so that they're not riding around for an hour and a half to get, 5 miles to their job or something like that. So that's certainly a big part of it. And as to the funding question, the report doesn't touch on this, but our work looks a lot about how we could reprioritize even a little bit from expanding highways to public transportation and local roads, and that would make a huge difference.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Cassie, what are you hoping policymakers, local, state, do with this?
Yes. So again, the report is used as an educational tool, but our coalition has been working a lot on making sure that we're prioritizing the right thing that we're spending our money on. And so regardless of how we're bringing in money into transportation, we need to be prioritizing things that get people where they need to go.
Cassie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Cassandra Steiner is the Personal Relations and Outreach Associate for the Sierra Club of Wisconsin, and she's a co-author of the new report, Arrive Together, Transportation Access and Equity in Wisconsin. She was with us to talk about issues surrounding Wisconsin's public transportation systems in communities around the state and what could be done to improve them. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can always tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, emergency room surgeons and other doctors are speaking out about deaths and injuries from firearms. We'll find out why they say we should treat gun deaths and injuries as a public health problem. If you or someone in your family is hooked on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and so on, we've got some help for you. A guest tells us how we can help kick the habit. And does the 5-second rule really work? We'll get some scientific answers with the authors of the book, Did You Just Eat That? That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow from 6:30 to 7:30, get a close look at the referenda on last week's ballots, including votes on the dark store loophole, school funding measures, and how a referendum gets on a ballot in the first place. That's tomorrow from 6:30 to 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we hear about a golf course proposal that could bring economic benefits to northeastern Wisconsin, but is raising environmental concerns from residents and retired DNR employees. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.